The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Obviously, it's not, a lot of people here, so this is very informal, so just feel free to be casual. I'm Monica, I'm one out here at the CO. And basically, the goal of this session is to really discuss the options and opportunities after graduation. We have three distinguished panelists today. To my right is Ms. Sabrina Valdez-Mola. She is hired as the Executive Director and Staff Attorney at the Center for Immigration Law and Practice, and she counsels clients with affirmative and defensive asylum, permanent residence, and visa cases, and represents them in immigration courts. To her right is Mr. Kara Kundar. He works at the Asian Pacific American Legal Resource Center. He implements the Housing and Community Justice Project at the APALRC, which provides legal services and resources to Asian American tenants and community groups in the DC area. To his right is Mr. Rahul Saxena. He staffs the NYCLU's Legislative Office in Albany, where he monitors, performs analysis, and advocates on legislation for members of the New York State Senate and Assembly. So basically, we are going to start this off with introductions, and then we're going to go to the questions that I have for the panelists, and the last 20 minutes will be Q&A from you guys. So the first question I have for all of you is, what was the turning point in law school, or before, that led you to pursue work that benefits immigrant communities and communities of color? And also, if you could just expand on your job description as well.
I'll start. First of all, I want to say thank you very much for inviting me back to WCL, and especially in this format, student to student or former student to current student or what have you. It's a real honor to be here and a privilege, and it's good to see you all this early morning on a Saturday in the midst of a very hectic time for you all. So thanks for coming. My name is Sabrina. The trajectory of my job experience, I guess, is I was hired as the sole staff attorney at an office in a Sunday school classroom doing immigrant legal assistance, and eventually the program became incorporated into UDC Law School. So now, in addition to maintaining a caseload, I teach, which is something that I didn't expect to do so soon right out of law school, but it was appropriate for me because I was in the clinic here. It was a tremendous experience for me. I came to law school thinking I wanted to do human rights work, and this is a great place to do human rights work, obviously, but as I was doing it more and more, I realized that I would much rather be out in the community and doing things face-to-face than sitting behind a computer researching high-minded theories. I wanted to see how people were living them, and immigration is a perfect way to do that because it's human-based, and you can have that connection with somebody and help them personally while speaking to these larger, noble issues that sort of motivated us all to pursue law degrees in the first place. So because I teach now, I also have the opportunity to mold people's minds or sort of, that's not pedagogically appropriate for me to say probably, but the opportunity to sort of get people to think broadly about doing social justice work and to challenge. My favorite part, I think, has been encouraging students to broadly think about what it means to be undocumented. And, you know, whether the laws that allow you to become documented are just or not. So we do a lot of out-of-the-box thinking, and that's been really great for me and allows me to sort of engage with these issues that motivated my legal education in the first place.
All you.
So I actually, I was a non-traditional student in that I worked for 10 years before I came to law school. So I have worked in nonprofits pretty much since graduating undergrad, and mainly in Asian American communities. I guess basically the work I was doing was policy advocacy work, some supportive local nonprofits, some arts advocacy stuff, and various miscellaneous. But a lot of the work, particularly after September 11th, I was in New York City, and my work was You know, initially we were doing some policy advocacy, and then we just realized that there were gaps in terms of service provision, so we had to start up another office, and I managed that office where we were providing direct services. A lot of just kind of case management and helping people who were dealing with either losing a loved one, discrimination and bias, detentions, you know, losing their jobs, losing their homes, et cetera, after September 11th in New York City, particularly in Asian immigrant communities. And the staff I hired were doing direct services, but it still wasn't, they were doing a lot of referrals and they were doing some support to folks, but I was managing, you know, and so I got a better understanding of what people were dealing with, but I was getting really tired of just saying, oh, you should call this person, you should call that person. At a certain point, it just felt like I was pushing paper or was, you know, referring people, not really doing anything. And so I really wanted to be able to provide direct services myself. So that was one piece of this, was I just wanted to be at the end of the chain of referrals. I wanted to actually be able to help people and not just talk about them or talk about their issues. And that's why I firmly believe when people talk about policy, and I think Green has heard me talk about this before, I really feel like anybody can do policy work, and I really feel that people who are really directly being affected by the issues should be doing the policy work. And there are a lot of people who make money, maybe not a lot of money, but they make money talking about issues all the time, but they don't really, they're not at sort of that critical moment or that critical juncture when somebody is at a point of crisis. They're just talking about it from up here. So I didn't want to do that, and the organization I was at, that was kind of where they were. So for me, it was like a social worker in law school, and I knew by working with social workers that I wouldn't be able to do it, and I think, you know, the respect I have for social workers has really grown so much by working directly with folks, but I knew it wasn't for me. And the second piece of this whole thing was I really wanted to figure out how to do more transformative kind of work to help communities that are trying to build something. So I have had this interest in, you know, transactional work as a way of facilitating, like, the building of community power. And I didn't really have any of the framework to talk about it. So if you talk to me when I started law school, I had vague ideas about these things, but I really didn't know. And I have to say, a lot of it came from talking to people in the school, and I'll talk more about this later, but talking to my like peers who were students, who some had really been thinking about this stuff, even if they hadn't worked very much, really kind of advanced frameworks of, like, how do you, you know, tear these things apart? How do you tear apart the idea of being, like, a lawyer, you know, and the privilege attached to that? And how do you facilitate, like, real kind of community building? So that's what took me to sort of where, you know, where I started and then where I ended law school. And it's still kind of a journey.
That'll be short. So I came to law school also wanting to do human rights, civil rights stuff. There wasn't really a specific point in law school where I decided to do what I wanted to do, because for me, law school was kind of like a continuous series of reminders why I want to do what I want to do, starting with the infamous race riots, Section 4 race riots, Section 4 e-race riots, I should say, of 2005. That was kind of like the event that kind of framed law school for me. In my third year, I was in the International Human Rights Clinic, and I realized then that doing direct service work, which, so the direct service work versus, you know, kind of more broad work was kind of a big issue for me in deciding what I wanted to do. And in the Human Rights Clinic, I found over the course of the year, it was an amazing experience, and for those of you that are not in the clinic, I really, really recommend it. It was probably the best part of law school for me. Well, that and Marshall Brennan, which you should also do. But I found that having to represent clients in, like, immigration court or whatever within the confines of the INA was just too frustrating for me. I just couldn't do it because I'm like, I really want to advocate for my clients, but I can't do it in the confines of really bad law. So that kind of drove me to want to work for an organization where I'm working towards changing the law instead of working within the confines of bad laws. So that's what, I guess, drove me to the NYCLU. I still struggle with the direct service work versus, you know, advocacy work at the NYCLU, and I think it's probably the biggest issue that I struggle with on a day-to-day basis, because the NYCLU doesn't do any direct service work, and what Prabh was referring to earlier, it's very obvious, I think, and not to hate on my organization, but it's very obvious in the day-to-day activities that we don't represent individual clients because our priorities are kind of messed up, in my opinion. But I mean, you know, I work on some pretty interesting issues. I work on same-sex marriage and drug law reform, immigrant rights issues. So that's my spiel.
Great. I know some of you guys have touched on this already, but how is there something specific you did in law school to reflect your values and principles around social justice? I know you were in several programs in school, but anything specifically to gear you towards your career in the future? Feel free.
I guess we'll go back to that one. like I said, I was in the immigration clinic and I was in Marshall Brennan, and those were probably the two best things for me. After graduating from law school, which was just a year ago, I really was very seriously considering becoming a high school teacher because I just loved Marshall Brennan so much. are any of you in it?
I was going to ask, is everyone in WCO? Because if not, then maybe you want to explain.
Oh, sorry. Marshall Brennan is a program in WCL where students can teach constitutional law in the local public high schools. And it was really an eye-opening experience. And it was, do you guys have good experiences with it? Are you in it?
I'm gonna be in it, but I'm a 1L now. Yeah. But I just guessed Todd.
Got it. Yeah. You're going to be doing it.
Yeah.
Oh, good luck. It's awesome. You'll love it. It's really hard, but it's a really wonderful experience, and it reminds you, you know, every day, like you sit in classes every day, especially as a 1L, and you go to torts and property, and everything is just so abstract and like so, you know, unpractical, but Teaching high school students is a really wonderful experience. So that, you know, that really informed what I do today. A lot of the work I do is students' rights work at the NYCLU, so it's important.
I guess for me, the 1L year was really disempowering because I think we kept being told that you can't get involved in stuff. And, you know, for most people, I mean, you came in doing something or you have a full three-dimensional life, and coming to law school, and it's sort of like, you know, just learn property, learn, you know, torts, learn this new language, and don't do anything that you care about. So that was really hard. I mean, I actually feel like I was probably depressed half the time, and I didn't really even realize it because it was just not what I thought I was getting into, particularly the way that the school talks about all these different things, and you know people are doing stuff as 2Ls and 3Ls. So I just started to like kind of seek out other students and then other like spaces in which, you know, I could connect to people directly, and you know, it helped me to, like I said, I think earlier, clarify the things that were most important to me. And sometimes those spaces don't exist. You know, sometimes you have to kind of create those spaces. But again, like particularly with WCL, but I think this is true in other places, in other law schools, that there are like pockets of people. You just have to find them, you know, people who can really kind of inform you and help you to kind of develop in terms of their own thinking, you know, and there are people who I consider friends, you know, and will consider friends straight, like long after the whole law school thing, you know, has ended. So that was really important for me, and I also didn't buy the hype. I mean, I didn't buy the hype that you need to be on journal and you need to be in moot court. I think those things are important if you want to do them. But the fact that, you know, they really emphasize sometimes that you have to do this or you have to do that, I didn't feel like that was very helpful at all.
I really echo, I guess, those sentiments, is that there's a lot of different kinds of ways to practice law, a lot of different ways to conceive yourself as an advocate post-law school. And the law school pedagogy sort of reinforces a very traditional notion of lawyering. And the beauty about this law school, I think, is that there are a lot of people who are outside that mold and who are not interested in doing, you know, practicing law in the same way it was practiced, you know, 50 years ago. So I would really, I say, definitely seek out your like-minded colleagues because they're going to be your a source of strength for you afterwards as you consider the realities of practice. And so I would say definitely those social connections are important. Yeah, the hype thing is definitely, especially, I mean, because the reality is that, you know, you're trained in these core subjects, you sit for an exam where someone tells you, you know, like, enforces these rote memorization of these different topics that bears no relation at all to what the reality of practice is like, so... Don't let the man get you down, guys. It's temporary. And the beauty of practice is that you really do sort of get to define your professional persona and who you want to be after law school. You can tell I was not a big law school person. Some people look back on it as a really positive part of their life, which is great. If that's you, wonderful. Congratulations. But my second and third year of law school, I was never here. I worked 3 days a week off-site and came back at night for classes 2 days a week. And because I wanted to, I mean, I was working for a local organization and just... So I saw, you know, besides the social connections I got here at law school, I immersed myself in what was going on in the D.C. community and got experience working on these issues. And I think without that experience, I would not have survived my 3 years in law school. It was the reminder that there was a real world out there and that eventually I was going to have my license and no one could, like, quiz me on civil procedure, like, calling on me cold. You know, it was really empowering for me and sort of my light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, the funny thing is that, I mean, I think most people have a very, like, hateful memory of law school. I think that's just natural. For me personally, I have no desire to practice the law, but I really enjoyed law school. And I think that maybe it was just because of the school and the people here and the professors here, but I also didn't really buy into the hype of journal and all that. But I thought it was a really great 3 years, and I definitely learned a lot. I don't know if I'll ever use what I learned, but I enjoyed it. I hope you are too.
If I could actually add to that, like, for me, the really interesting thing was I came with a vague sense of sort of like the political framework. I was sort of like, you know, kind of like, oh, I'm liberal and I kind of get it. But I really got challenged along here, and I think not necessarily by the professors, but definitely by my classmates, and that really helped me. I mean, it helped me a lot in terms of, I'm not saying I'm at, like, the end of anything, but it helped me to, number one, realize how little I've understood, and it helped me to realize how much I, like, of a learning process this whole engagement with the law and the legal profession is. And it's, like, a lot of it was definitely, like, in the cafeteria and in the library and doing things, you know, talking to people about things that we were dealing with at the time. And the intersections between sort of what was happening at the law school and things happening nationally and things happening globally and locally. And I think that's one of the things that I really value about being here, was that you had people, you know, I came here with a very clear domestic kind of framework about sort of issues around, you know, poverty law, issues around poor people when it comes to in the U.S. And I had friends who really came in with, like, a very clear sort of international, you know, or transnational kind of lens. And being able to talk about poverty, displacement, all these other things in so many different contexts at the same time was really, really helpful for me.
Okay, switching to post-graduation, what advice do you have for 3Ls who are currently applying for public interest jobs or fellowships?
Are there any 3Ls?
Oh, rising, rising, 3Ls.
We're all
rising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll be freaking out soon enough.
Yeah.
What is a 3L?
Third year.
Oh.
I think Praj should go first.
Yeah, I agree.
Me?
Yeah.
advice. Don't freak out.
Sorry.
It's not too late to develop relationships with professors, and I think that you should do that. If you haven't done that, if you're a 1L now and a rising 2L to be or whatever, really develop relationships with professors. Even if you just have one person, that person can be an oasis in this place, or any place. I was just really lucky because the professor who I got to know was really warm and really open, but there are a lot of professors like that here. You know, maybe it's not even the majority, but it's more than a lot of other law schools. So that's like the very tangible thing, and it also is like what I was able to seek out while I was here that helped me a lot. I mean, professors have a lot of links to a lot of things that they're doing that this is really weird. Anyway,
you take pictures while he's laughing.
That's what I was saying.
If you guys could also maybe tell us, like, in advice, but how you got your job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you.
The beginning of the third year, I applied for SCADA and EJW, didn't get either of them. I applied for about maybe five or six jobs over the course of second semester of my third year, and I didn't get any of them. I had some second round interviews, and I was really close in a couple of them, but didn't get any of them. I studied for the bar, and during bar period, I was interviewing for jobs also, which was really fun. I would go to Barbary in the morning, and then drive to New York City right after Barbary and go for an interview. Yeah.
From D.C.?
No, I was at home in Connecticut, my parents' place. And then right after the bar, if you don't mind a quick story, I took the bar in Albany at the Crown Plaza. I didn't have my job yet then. And I remember going to Albany and being like, God, this town sucks. I hate this town. Who would ever live here? And then right after the bar, I applied for like 10 jobs, and I had two second round interviews in mid-September. One of them was with the NYCLU for the job that I currently have, which is headquartered in Albany, across the street from the Crown Plaza where I take the bar.
Cheers with a group reminder. You never know.
But all the jobs I applied for, except for my SCADA and EJW jobs, pretty much all of them were kind of advocacy and, you know, lobby. I'm a registered lobbyist in New York. I don't tell people that, but that kind of lobbying work. I've had very few direct service jobs. So that's me.
Okay, I should preface this by saying that I'm not a big networking. They tell you, especially in D.C., oh, network. I just feel weird doing it. I feel so weird, and I realize I'll come to terms with it eventually, probably. But I found that, like, one of the best ways to meet people and, like, network without networking is volunteering, which I do a lot of for community law clinics and events, and Citizenship Day was last weekend, and I was there. So, like, I would just start going to these different events and, like, be helpful and shake a lot of hands. And that actually was how I got my first job, or my only job. I just graduated 2 years ago. And it was actually also with the help of a WCL alum who said, you know, my boyfriend is on the board of this organization that's hiring. She called the public interest office and said, do you know anybody who might be interested in doing this kind of work? And then I, you know, met this guy at this volunteer event, which I didn't even know he was going to be there. He just came up and introduced himself to me, and he eventually pulled for me. He was really all about getting somebody who was, he said, young and energetic, but I think what he meant was someone without a family and children. Willing to work really long hours and for not very much money. But I walked in there and I was like, they were like, are you okay without having a support staff? Or I didn't even have a license at the time when I started this job. Are you okay with having the, you know, no supervision, no legal support staff, and of course I'm right out of law school, what can't I do, right? I'm like, yes, I can do anything, I'm powerful. So I was like my own naivete that landed me this job. So I would say confidence in yourself is huge, even if it's false confidence. Volunteering is a really good way to meet people. The alumni network is really supportive, and I've actually started I know this isn't, I already have a job, but I am all about sort of creating networks where none currently exist. So, like, a group of us started a happy hour, monthly happy hour for WCL alums who practice immigration law. And if you're interested in that, you should let me know so I can invite you to the happy hour, so you can network. But we all sort of support each other. We know who's moving into what job, and we all, that's also a network to get better at what we're all doing currently in terms of drawing on others' expertise. And we restarted the Capital Area Muslim Bar Association as a way for us to all network with each other too and provide support for that community. So I would say, you know, be creative. And if the opportunity you're looking for, the area that you're looking for to have a conversation doesn't exist, like, move forward, be proactive and create one, because there's probably other like-minded people out there who are also interested in it. Oh, and another thing that I wanted to say is another really good way, I think there was a question about this before, but about, like, moving from one area to another. Like, you know, you might have thought, like, me wanted to do human rights work, you know, my whole way through law school, and then third year I had this revelation that I was, like, going to be an immigration lawyer, and I was like, shit, I haven't done anything related to immigration law. That a great way to do that is research and scholarship. And you have a great support network here at the law school, and they're supportive even of alums. So doing your own independent research and writing something for publication, I know that sounds very law review-y, but it's a great way to build an expertise in an area where, you know, you have an extreme interest but maybe don't have a lot of experience. It's a great way to move laterally.
You know, can I actually add, because I think that Sabrina Rowell brought up a lot of really great points, and it reminded me of some stuff that might be useful. So first of all, just in terms of how I got my job, it was like a two-year conversation with the organization that I work with now, the Asian Pacific American Legal Resource Center. I'm lucky because there was a relationship sort of there already with the existing executive director. But it really started with, like, I would not apply for a fellowship, you know, and working with them to kind of come up with a project. And then that, I didn't even get an interview for my fellowship applications, but the conversation continued. And, you know, I realized through this conversation that the organization was in a place to have something that was a little different from what it's currently doing or was doing. And then they realized, like, look, this guy's really dedicated. He's trying to make something work. And I actually got, I mean, I got my offer like the end of May. So I graduated and I didn't know what was going to happen. So, you know, the timeline isn't the same as it is for some of the other jobs out there. So don't lose hope.
And don't freak out.
Yeah, freaking out doesn't help. Because we can smile. As an employer. The other thing that I would say, in terms of volunteering, my organization actually runs a helpline for Asian communities. In the district and in the area. And the helpline, you know, we really do look for folks who are bilingual to run the helpline or to help us with the helpline. And, you know, we have a line that's dedicated to Hindi and Urdu, but we're also looking for more Punjabi speakers, Nepali speakers. You know, the populations are constantly changing, Gujarati speakers, because we have clients who are Gujarati speaking, and my Gujarati is not that great. So that's a really easy way. You don't need to have, like, a full-on 10-hour a week internship to, you know, kind of see what it's like and also to kind of make those connections. And in terms of networking, I mean, we have about 10 to 15 students who work every semester in our organization, you know, just doing like 2 or 3 hours a week and just being there consistently. And I mean, I can't tell you, like, our staff attorneys talk about the 3Ls who aren't placed, and we try actively to help place them. You know, like, we'll make a call, we have friends. I mean, you know, as you get into this field, it's a very small world. And we will actively try to help people who we actually know. And it doesn't mean it's all successful, but you can use other people's networks as well. And you've developed a relationship with an organization. You know, and nonprofits, at least most nonprofits, I mean, people care about people, you know, and I can't tell you enough how important that is. And that would be true for the, you know, the Employment Justice Center, for a lot of the other organizations, the CARE Coalition. You know, we all know people who work in a lot of these organizations, and particularly like the WCL alumni network, people really want to support WCL students. I mean, I know for me, if I have a choice, you know, between like a GW student, no offense, we have a lot of GW students and a WCL student, I will definitely give that WCL student another, you know, like, I'll at least like say, okay, like what are you interested in? Have you thought about the clinics? If the person's like, we have a clinical program, then that's a whole you know, story. But I would definitely say, you know, like make those informational interviews, like, you know, find people who you think are alum, who maybe are doing something interesting, or maybe they're not doing anything, you know, that is clear right now, but you talk to somebody and they said, oh yeah, that person was really active on campus, you know, in reforming the clinic's travel reimbursement program, whatever. Like, you know, people who aren't afraid of sort of the system. I had to use that example. But I'm just kind of saying, like, I know sometimes you get the whole schmoozy networking thing, but particularly, like, my one last example I'll give is my sister graduated from NYU Law School 3 years ago. I think she hates that I use this example. But she works in a firm, which I won't name, where I get free stuff. She wants to leave. And, you know, she's bright. She did a lot of really good stuff on campus. But then, you know, she worked straight, you know, went straight to the firm. And she applies to places, and she doesn't tell me. And it's places where I know people. And I'm like, I'm your brother. You know, like, please let me know. She's like, I want to get out on my own merits. It is not a meritocracy. I mean, you know, like, that's not the right word. It's not really, like, you're not going to get hired based on somebody saying you should really interview this person. You're going to get hired on your merits. You're going to get hired on what, like, how you interview. But you may not get that interview. And getting that interview is, like, it's important. You know, it's important for them to be able to realize what a superstar you are. But, you know, I mean, if we get 50 resumes and somebody I know and trust tells me you should really look at this person, I'm going to look at that person. So use us.
Great. For those people who are interested in public interest, are there any forms of employment that are often overlooked that people should look towards? Especially in this economy, it's hard to get jobs these days, so any other kind of employment that people just don't think about that they would be interested in?
Just because you went to law school doesn't mean you have to be a lawyer.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? Like, specifically, like, what can you do? And, like, oh, you know, you said you don't want to practice, so, mm-hmm. While you're a registered lobbyist, we all know, so, like, what else? Like,
I started a blog. Like I said earlier, I was very seriously considering becoming a high school teacher. And I mean, obviously that's not for everybody, but I think that my law degree would really help me get a job as a high school teacher. And if that's what you like to do, then you should do it. Similarly, I also really kind of want to be a journalist, so I started a blog. I haven't really showed it to anyone except three people. But I mean, there's a huge place for people with legal training in journalism. So trying to think outside. I mean, not that's necessarily public interest, but that, like it is depending on what you do. But you know, try not to. If you're open to exploring other things, I would you know just approach it with a very open mind.
I would say don't feel. You know, bills are bills. You've got to pay them. Loans are loans. You've got to pay them. And, you know, if it's a matter of taking a job, you know, where, you know, like, you shouldn't feel bad or compromised or that you can't move into public interest work if your first job out of law school is not what you imagined doing. If you thought you wanted to work for a nonprofit, you're positive you need to do it, you need to take a job with a firm or you need to take a job doing something else, there's no, like, That's actually a pretty common story, and so you shouldn't feel like you've given up, you know, your whole thing. I would just say find other ways to engage your interests, whether it's a blog or you know, if you're into teaching, if you want to do work in the community with tutoring or whatever it is, whatever your interests are, do not lose sight of your interests. Like, still remember why you came here. You just have to keep that flame burning, and the opportunity will arise for you. But, you know, you have to sort of... You have to steel yourself because you're right. This economy is not great, and actually, a lot of and you know, there are people who are happy with their first jobs out of law school, but there's a lot of people who are unhappy also. And that's like the reality of working, is that because the job might just not be what you expected it. But just remember what you were interested in and what you want to do eventually, and don't give up on that.
I
want to add something quickly to that. I talked to somebody from the UN. He was a UN human rights lawyer. He's deputy director of the Commission on Human Rights in New York City. And he was, I'm just adding this to what you said. I asked him, actually, you know, he's this big lawyer. He's done all this work. And he said, you know, he did corporate law for 10 years. He came out, and before he used to do a lot of activism, during law school, he still was involved in activism, a lot of Palestinian things, Palestinian rights things, and then he did corporate law for 10 years. And I told, and I asked him, I said, well, you know, you did corporate law, and, you know, now you're in this great position, but how did you sort of keep, because he was so cool. Like, I talked to him, and he was really cool and laid back, and I was just like, wow, he's not this weird, stuck-up kind of guy. And he said, you know, even when I was in corporate law, he's like, I know this sounds crazy, but maybe it was a mistake. In the beginning, I asked my employer, I'm going to do some pro bono. No matter what happens, I'm going to do pro bono somewhere. He worked 60 hours a week and then did pro bono on top of that for, like, something. And it was hard, but he kept being in touch with organizations, even while being a corporate lawyer, to keys that I never lost that vein because I always loved human rights. So it's obviously hard, and I'm not a lawyer, but I'm just trying. I think that is valuable to law students to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I do want to say one thing, though. There's a very clear gender issue when it comes to working in firms, and I can say this directly from, like, what my sister's experience is, not from my own, that you definitely have to be mindful of that. And you have to be mindful of where you are in terms of the totem pole of firm work, as a, you know, person of color, as a woman of color, as an immigrant, as a child of immigrants. Like, there's a lot of different things going on there. So I don't want to say firms are terrible by any means, but I definitely would say you only live once, and I personally just feel like, you know, you have to be true to what you want to do. It's going to be hard, but so what? I mean, you know, like, I get up in the morning, I make less money than, I don't know, a lot of people. And I also make more money than a lot of people, right? So I'm really privileged in that way, and I'm lucky to be able to get up in the morning and pretty much every day be like, I can't wait to get going, you know? And I don't have a lot of, you know, it's like, I don't have time. I don't have time to waste. And I know that. And I would say personally, like, if you feel passionately about something, you know, life is hard. I mean, some people, you know, the people that we're talking about, like, their lives are much harder, you know? And you're living as a student. And generally speaking, like, you know, as a student, you're kind of budgeting already. If you can maintain that, then there's the ability to be able to do that when you're working as well. And personally, I just feel like the jobs are hard to get. They're very competitive now, and it's getting increasingly more competitive. But I would say very, very strongly, like, you know, fight for a strong loan repayment program at the school. Understand the loan repayment program at the school, at the jurisdiction you want to work at, the federal program. There are ways to make this work, but don't compromise. I mean, I think what Sabrina was saying is really true, that it's okay, but be careful that you don't get trapped into a career. Because you can do anything to make money if you need to make money. So don't get locked into something and then in 2 years be like, oh, I could be a partner and then I could do X. Because then you just get stuck. And there's a lot of people who get stuck. There's a lot of people who say, yeah, you know, it would have been great. But, you know, I have this one case that I've done, like, in 2 years. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are happy. And there's a lot of people who are really happy with, you know, the things that come with the resources. But I would really say, if you're considering this work, even though it's really difficult, I'm speaking from a position of having a job, which is a position of privilege as well, don't compromise. Let's short. Let's really short.
I take a little switch here. I know you guys talked about networking a little bit, but I wanted to know if you could give examples of how you continue to network. I know some of you are in bar associations, but do you have, like, other organizations you're involved in? Do you have, like, go to, or how do you continue to stay in touch with other people in your field?
I mean, I'm also a terrible networker, and I've never, especially here in D.C., everybody always talks about networking, and yes, it's important, but But there are ways to do it. I mean, if you're not comfortable just like schmoozing, I'm not a schmoozer, even though I'm a registered lobbyist. but there are ways of, you know, of targeting people that you genuinely want to talk to and keeping in touch with them. And, you know, for me, I worked with some really amazing people in my internships, for example, and I keep in touch with them just not because I want to use them later on, but because I'm genuinely interested in knowing what they're up to. And that includes the people, your co-interns, because all my co-interns who are going through law school when I was going through law school are now doing really amazing stuff. And at some point, you know, it's good to know. It's good to know. Keep track of their careers. And Facebook. Facebook is great.
You already talked a lot about the different like things that I'm doing, but I would also say that there are different organizations that are, like, as an immigration lawyer, I'm a member of ALA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, which is really good for, a lot of these are really immigration specific, but they're really good to their new members. They have a new members division, and they have a mentorship network. They have special trainings. It's easy to get in free to a lot of ALA events if you're new and you work for a legal services organization, or if you're willing to volunteer to come in. It's a great resource for training. They have a huge online library that you can use if you don't have Westlaw and you need to do research. Hypothetically, that's a really great resource, and also more radical and is the National Immigration Project, which is run through the National Lawyers Guild, and that actually ALA's sort of focused very heavily on business immigration and these other things, and the people who are with NIP do a lot more removal defense, so they're grappling with a lot harder issues. I think the ethical framework they use when they look at their clients is a lot like what I use, and so there's a lot of conversations like within the NIP circle about like ethical frameworks when you're representing marginalized populations and all that stuff. So that having that conversation with people, it's great to have a place to do that. And also starting groups around common interests, like the instructors at the law school where I teach, we have a weekly meetings on different issues in teaching, and are setting up a scholarship group for the summer. So we had, you know, again, I would say be proactive and sort of create a circle around common interests. That's the most natural way to network, or like networking alternatives.
Okay, great. This is my last question. I'll open up the floor for Q&A. But this is obviously a very broad question, but how can lawyers be useful in social work, besides the obvious, maybe things that we aren't even considering, but just certain like community activities or other ways that you in your career could be useful to others?
I would say that, you know, no matter what job you take, I think the point about being able to stay engaged is a really critical one. And I think that the fact that you all are here and the fact that you all are kind of interested in some way is a really good one, you know, and that's a good place to start from. And that as lawyers, we're going to have a lot of technical skills, or we'll be developing a lot of technical skills and networks that can also help, you know, some of the organizations that are already out there, some of the efforts that are already out there. And so I would say, like, there's a way, you know, frankly, and this is actually a very relevant point right now with deferred associates going, you know, this issue that's happening is the front line. I mean, there's only so many positions, you know, there's only so many places for people to be working in those jobs. And, you know, it's not for everybody. But that work also really needs to be supported. And it can be supported by people who take pro bono cases. You know, law firms are really critical in terms of just being able to help with like more complex cases, and also just the sheer sort of vast number of things that people are trying to deal with. And then I think that, you know, there's this kind of really important need for strong, smart, and progressive board members, because there are a lot of people, sort of the old guard, who really view certain things in a very tight box, that this is what direct services means, or this is what social justice means, or even just like a nonprofit should be doing. And if you have people who actually have values that more closely reflect where the community is, or more closely reflect where some of the younger people who are trying to run the organizations are, it can really, really help. And you have friends from undergrad or other places who actually have, maybe they're accountants, maybe they're doctors, maybe they're in other professional fields. You know, somebody who's an IT person can be an incredibly useful person to connect to a nonprofit. So your own personal networks, your friend networks, you never know. I mean, we've also been referred to people who have these technical skills in whatever field. And, for my organization, we have a lot of lawyers on our board, and we really don't want all lawyers on our board. We want, people who understand issues, but who are also willing to kind of view it from a very different lens and tell us, this doesn't make sense. I'm a social worker, and this just doesn't make sense. Why are you thinking of it this way? Or I'm an accountant, and, you should really be thinking about X, I was a client of your organization, so you never know. There's a lot of ways in which people, yourselves for sure, but then even people you know can really kind of connect. I think we talk a lot about networking in terms of like meeting people you don't know, and we don't necessarily always talk about the people who you do know, who at this time maybe are your peers and don't have these expertise or these same skill sets, but as they move forward in their careers, they're going to become, established people in the community, or they can be. And I can't say enough like how important that is in terms of like just trying to build something. Because it's not good enough to have people who all believe the same thing to talk, talking to each other. We really need to broaden us to talk to a lot of other people. I'd say that there's some baseline when it comes to like community-based work.
And I would say the other side of that is listening. Besides talking, and I think that's a huge, very important skill for lawyers who want to be a part of social change movements, is that often the locus of change, there are people who are directly affected by, whatever it is that needs the changing, and there are already leaders within those movements and people who sort of intimately understand the problem. And so listening, deferring in some cases to those people, it's hard to do. I think that, your JD is sort of like the, that's what I thought of it. I was like, this is my equipment, right, to go out and like do what I want to do, but recognizing that it might not always be appropriate, and that my paradigm for approaching these problems might be in direct conflict with the people who are already leading that movement. So I would say there's actually a quite a lot of tension between specifically organizers and lawyers, and so I would encourage you all to sort of to listen and to be considerate of those things. And I think that there's really, really, I would actually really like to see that relationship between organizers and lawyers change dramatically and evolve so that people can truly support each other. But I think that listening, the talking and the listening, are both equally important.
I would say actually the same exact thing. And I'll give an example of where in my job, I think I alluded in the beginning about some frustrations that I have. An example of how lawyers can be really helpful in terms of promoting social justice causes, but also be an obstruction. So I find in my job that I just because I have a law background and I'm a lawyer, it's sometimes easier for me to get a meeting, for example, with a senator or an assemblyman and they'll pay more attention to me just because of that. That's messed up in and of itself, but that's just the way that it is. But the problem is that when organizations and lawyers, they get so caught up in that role that they don't have a connection to. Sometimes they lose sight of their connection to the communities that they purport to be serving. And one example of that I'm dealing with right now is a very specific piece of legislation that is supposedly for transgender rights. It's called the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act. And what it does is it includes in New York State human rights law gender identity and gender expression as a protected class. But it also has a provision that would add it to, that would add gender identity and expression to the hate crime statute in New York. And all the transgender organizations, or most of them, all the groups that work with the transgender communities in New York City and across New York State, they all oppose this piece of legislation because they oppose the hate crimes provision. But the big advocacy groups, my organization, the Empire State Pride Agenda, which is the biggest LGBT advocacy organization in New York, we all support it very strongly, and we're all pushing very hard for it. And it gets very frustrating because we are the lawyers and they are the community groups, and there's this very obvious disconnect between the two different groups, just two sets of groups. And I try every day to remind myself and to remind my organization that we are lawyers, we have a place, and there are times when we should speak up, and there are times when we should, you know, we should listen, really. And I find it very hard within my organization to get that message across. And I hope that, you know, at least the younger lawyers in my organization, I think, get it. And I hope that when you all are lawyers, that you will remember that. That's my expert words of advice for you.
Just out of, like, intellectual curiosity, why do you think it is that they oppose the hate crime part?
I think for two reasons. One, as you probably know, hate crimes statutes work both ways and not a one-way street. So, for example, the case Wisconsin, or Mitchell versus Wisconsin, which was the Supreme Court case that upheld hate crimes legislation, it was the case of a group of young black men who, after seeing the film Mississippi Burning, they got very angry and they ended up assaulting a white man. And so the black men were convicted under the hate crime statute for assaulting the white man. And because of the way that law enforcement works in this country, obviously, you know, cops target people of color, they target already oppressed communities. A lot of people in the transgender community are scared that these hate crime statutes will be used against them. But as a broader point, they also oppose hate crimes because, you know, a lot of people just oppose, and I mean, I'm with them on this, oppose the prison industrial complex. They oppose extending prison sentences for anybody. That's what hate crime statutes do.
Any questions from the audience?
I actually have a question for Sabrina. I know you said only 2 years out you got an opportunity to teach. And I was just wondering even if it's like, you know, adjunct or it's just like, you know, some type of teaching, if like say you really enjoy Marshall Brennan and you want to continue teaching law and you can't necessarily do it in high school, how has, within so few years after, were you able to teach? And if some of us want to do that while working and just stay engaged with students, because I think maybe that's a great way to keep challenging yourself, is to like be in the presence of law students who are you know, pushing your buttons as well and like asking you you know, to rethink what things that you might be teaching them. How do you do that, and how do you apply for the other things that we should do now so that we can be, is it publishing? Like, what should I do if I want to teach on a very, you know, not on a high level, not necessarily tenured, but just keep engaging with students?
That's a really good question. In my case, it was totally dumb luck. Totally dumb luck. So absent dumb luck, some things that you can do. First of all, I would say there are fellowships for teaching in clinical programs, if that's something specifically you're interested in. Sometimes they take people right out of law school, other times they want people who are more experienced, but I would definitely keep aware of the programs that are available and the deadlines and the requirements, and always keep your eyes open for those opportunities. Something else that you can do is, there are a lot of adjunct positions that open up, usually for ethics and legal writing, and in areas where, you know, D.C., there's a lot of law schools. Most of those topics are taught by adjuncts, but there's opportunities, and actually sometimes positions open up through one of those. So if you're initially hired as an adjunct to do something, there's potential to move into a tenure position and teach something very specific based on knowledge or experience that you have. So that exists in some areas. So the other externship, the seminars are taught by adjuncts, I think, as well. So there's those, and I would say that scholarship is important. That's like what I'm learning. When I first started doing this, I didn't really know what the rules of the game were. And everyone was like, oh, yeah, you want respect, you've got to publish. And I was like, oh, Okay, now I know. And so sort of keeping an eye to research and writing, following up, you know, developing sort of triangulating maybe a field that you're interested in and just keeping really up to date with every little thing that happens within that field and building your own expertise and then hopefully being able to use it through one of these venues.
Can I add one quick thing, too? The one thing is, you mentioned law school, but a JD's recognized kind of as a PhD in some undergrad places, depending. So you could be an adjunct, actually, and teach whatever the hell you want.
Like what, Prague?
Well, I'm not going to speak on my behalf, but because I wasn't a JD at the time. But Deepa actually taught Asian Americans in the law. And so it was more of a historical sort of like social history or ethnic studies class. And, you know, there's like a flip to it, which is, well, why can someone who just has a JD be able to just teach something, whatever they want? But, you know, it's a way to kind of stay engaged. And if you have like a background in terms of your undergraduate, some people have graduate degrees, or if you've used your law school time to focus in on some specific things in terms of your research or in terms of your practice, you know, at the clinic. There are some undergraduate schools that actually, like, you know, they'd be willing to take you on for a semester. So, you know, I think it's not the same as teaching law school, but it was really a challenge. It was a challenge in a good way, but it was also like a way to engage younger folks and realize like some of the assumptions that I was walking in with. And then also to talk about stuff I actually really enjoy. You know? That was really cool.
I have a question. I was wondering if you guys, or the question to all three of you, if you know of any opportunities or ideas to engage in legal advocacy, specifically dealing with South Asian groups or the community, because I know there's fields that you can get into, like labor issues, immigration issues, domestic violence. That, I mean, like, that's a field that you can get into to work with the community, but is there any way to specifically just engage with South Asians? Are there organizations that you guys know of?
That work exclusively with South Asians?
Not exclusively, but, like, I guess a directed focus?
Well, I'm in my group.
Okay.
yeah, I mean, you know, three of our staff attorneys are South Asian.
Okay.
So we have, you know, three languages on staff. And so, I mean, I think that the fellowship route is a way of kind of being able to carve out a project, you know, but you don't, I think it also depends on geography, where you are, and you know, like, in terms of organizations, I mean, there are just, like, a handful of organizations that work within either immigrant communities and just, like, the people who are there.
Yeah, there's a packet, and I don't know if it's in this folder. It's in one of the folders I put together. I don't know. There's a packet of just all the different organizations, like all of the, what is it, the NCSO groups. And some of them have legal focus, and some of them focus, and some of them don't. But that's a list. I think probably, I mean, this is something that I've actually been struggling with too, is like if, you know, if you're concerned with specifically serving the South Asian community, how can you do it? And one way is to build, yeah, you know, we focus on a particular legal issue. And, but especially organizations where there are large South Asian populations and they're looking to hire people with language backgrounds, the idea is that that person is going to be the point person for serving that community. So you can sort of tell when you look at a position, like, whether or not there's that opportunity inherently. And I guess the other opportunity, yeah, fellowships or other forms of grant writing specifically for a position, if an organization is looking to do more outreach in that community.
Because there definitely are people who've done that in, like, New York and New Jersey, California, all over the country, who've said, like, I want to work specifically with survivors of domestic violence within the South Asian community. So there's both, like, the lens, like the racial or ethnic lens, and then there's also sort of an issue area lens. So, you know, there has to be some intersection. I work in a race, like sort of an organization that uses a framework of race, but I really question it a lot of times because I don't know if it's like, because there are people who are kind of in similar situations, but it, you know, like their national origin or their, you know, perceived race or whatever, it doesn't really, it's not the best organizing mechanism. So even for us, we do a lot of work around language access, and it crosses so many different communities. So that's why I asked in terms of specific, because it's hard to just focus in on one group now.
Any more questions? Go ahead.
I have a question that kind of departs from the law school perspective. I work with an organization, a community-based organization that required a lot of input from lawyers, but for ASHA for Women, which deals with domestic violence. And if you guys could provide input on how community-based organizations like us can be kind of better prepared or more efficient when we're kind of soliciting your services and working with you, that would be really helpful. I mean, you know, besides, I know that's not an easy question to answer, but a lot of times we have sort of a wide sort of ad hoc network of lawyers that we can tap, and so what can we kind of bring to the table in terms of how we're thinking that can kind of streamline and make it easier for us to work with you guys, whether it's on like specific cases or policy issues. I know it's like very overarching, but...
Well, we need to talk, actually, because I think we've been meaning to actually sit down with y'all. But I think sitting down and actually kind of working out, like, this is specifically what we do, and understanding of both sides, and understanding sort of intake processes. There's a lot of technical stuff, but I think collaborations between organizations are critical just because, like, the need is so great, but we're only, kind of touching the tip of the iceberg. So the very basic thing is in terms of referrals and understanding, like, how, for nonprofits and nonprofits, how do we both work? And what is your need? You know, for us, I think, like, we're really interested in finding out, like, the client base and the people that you're reaching, what do they need? And do we provide that, or can we help you to access that? I think for a lot of legal providers, like, for us, for example, we can't do everything. So we're trying to find places we can refer people or to build capacity in the community. You know? So particularly around the domestic violence, we recognize the Violence Against Women, the Violence Against Women Act, and provisions to help people get independent status, we could do a training. So we've trained attorneys who can take on pro bono cases now, but they come through us, basically, because they need guidance, because a lot of these attorneys, this isn't what they do every day. So they need someone to kind of help, you know, supervise in case something comes up, because there's always some other thing, you know, maybe there's a child custody. So that would be the immediate thing. And then collaboration, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity, particularly in domestic violence, to go beyond just a service model. And I think that's something we're really interested in. So I think conversation as a first and foremost. When it's independent lawyers, I don't really know. Because I know that a lot of organizations kind of, they have the two or three people that they feel like we can depend on them, they'll take on cases when they can. And I wouldn't say don't do that. I think if you have relationships, to continue those and make sure it's really clear, like, what their expectations are and what you can handle. That's from, like, what I've seen. And I'm very new at this, so.
Really helpful, because it's just a question of efficiency. Resources are so limited on both ends, so what's the best partnership?
I'm from Amity in New Jersey, and I'm the legal coordinator there, so my job is to coordinate legal things. It's very much a similar story. We work with domestic violence, family, immigration issues, and actually I'm missing a legal clinic right now. It's a free clinic that we run every month. Twice a month we run two free legal clinics. And I talked to you as well, because I think what you said is really important. And because many of the people in things like legal services are looking that field to work with the people, people who need it, and we're here begging for legal help. And it's also a disconnect, I think, because like things like family law, it's so involved that how can we possibly even take a case? It's too much, you know. So me personally, I'm right now in the midst of trying to expand a pro bono pool. I'm trying to reach out to like Muslim bar associations and everything like that. And it's really hard because they're busy. I don't want to just come up to them cold and they're going to bore you. You know, so I mean, I'd love to talk to you about it. But I understand, and I think there are a lot of issues, and I'm really trying to work with that.
Yeah, I think there just needs to be kind of a thinking through what that model, like, needs to be, and of course it's not a one-size-fits-all, but
yeah.
some sort of kind of broader understanding of every party, what they need.
And I think, I mean, it would be really great to have sort of this conversation, you know, amongst, because I think that some groups have been around for a long time, like Manavini, and I think that they've been able to work a lot of things out, and then it's great to kind of hear from your perspective. It's a real challenge, so. It's hard to place the family.
It's actually a really good thing to put for the ideas for the open session.
Yeah,
like I think that there's a board outside 603 where there are sessions, and so CBOs that need like attorney assistance, and that would be, I'm sure that there's that people, a lot of people come to that session.
Manavi's been around since like 1984, like almost 24 years, so we're one of the oldest South Asian like organizations, like women's orgs. So I think, I mean, we've worked things, lost things, you know, broke things have broken down and come back up. That's right, but it's good because, I mean, a lot of, there's Asha and the other newer, I don't know how old Asha is, but
20 years.
Oh, they're older, but there's other ones that I think could learn from Asha or Manavi about what to do right.
And sometimes just the, again, I think it's, it has to come back to a perspective of education, because a lot of these battles have been fought and there have been answers that have come up, but they either don't get passed down to the next generation in that nonprofit, and it's just inefficient and waste of time. So.
They need a book.
People read
the media.
I've actually wanted to do some kind of, I've been thinking about this since the last summit, actually, something on like law school for organizers, organizing school for lawyers, that specifically explores collaboration between CBOs, community organizers, and lawyers, because I do think that there are these things, and it'd be kind of neat to identify best practices and have a conversation about how we perceive things differently.
And actually, on that note, I'm actually going to be reaching out to direct legal service providers who work with Asian communities around the country, to just do a listserv for now, and then try to, you know, people who work in organizations like mine, and also people who are working, you know, maybe they work for New Jersey Legal Services, but they have like a whole, or whatever it's called, LSNJ, and they have like a whole docket of like clients who are pretty much all from the South Asian community, from another Asian community, to kind of connect to one another, because, I mean, we deal with language access issues every single day, any service provider can tell you, it's a critical thing, like, that you deal with the federal government, with every government agency, and then with service agencies who are supposed to be helping communities, you know, it's like, you know, hi, I need help, and they say it in Urdu, and then they just hang up on them, you know, and it's kind of like, you know, it's like, we have clients who get bounced around all the time, who have critical needs, who are at a moment of crisis, who finally had the courage to call, and they get hung up on. You know, so how do we coordinate amongst all of ourselves? And I was going to see if it makes sense to have just service providers as a whole to kind of connect to one another so that, you know, we can continue the dialogue.
I think we have time for one more. Go ahead.
I just have sort of like a quick comment on this and then another question for you guys, but I am from a community-based organization in Michigan, and we actually have a new project in Michigan. It's not for my organization, but sort of coming from the legal side, that's called the Michigan Immigrant Rights Project. And so what they are trying to do is sort of bridge the gap between the lawyers and the community-based organizations, and they just had a statewide summit where they brought together all the different community-based organizations to sort of meet with the legal community, and they're putting together sort of a comprehensive resource list so that both sides have it and we know who's out there and what's going on, and so far it's been really helpful. So to the extent that maybe you would want to look in to see their model, you can look them up on the web, and it might be helpful. Sort of for the panelists, my question, and I know we've touched on it a little, but I'm not actually a law student. I'm an organizer at heart, and I lead policy work now, but I've been considering going to law school. And sort of one of the challenges that I'm facing right now is I know a firm is just not for me at all. But like I said, I'm an organizer, and that's sort of the field that I would want to stay in, is sort of the nonprofit side. But at the same time, law school is so expensive, and it's really a challenge. Can you really make that work and balance so that you can do the kind of work that you want to be doing, but you still have all these financial obligations that you're going to be facing from actually going to law school? Sorry, it's a big question.
I would say research the LRAP programs at any law school you're considering.
The what?
The loan repayment assistance programs. Some schools have really excellent LRAP programs. Others don't have them at all. So, and I would ask a lot of questions. Do we have a list of questions asked about an LRAP program? I think, you know what Equal Justice Works does? Mm-hmm. Equal Justice Works has a whole thing about, they've been really good about advocating for, they're a group that advocates for public interest lawyers and law students, and they have a lot of stuff about LRAP programs and how to evaluate a program. And also the state bar associations and the district bar associations also have loan repayment assistance programs. And also, if public interest is really the way you want to go, there are schools that do offer a limited number of scholarships, but that do have scholars who've shown commitment to doing public interest work, and some of them are full rides. So I would just look and see, you know, what's available between those three.
And just generally look at schools' tuitions. I mean, this is a very expensive school, but there are some really great schools like UD, which I'm not. And also have, I mean, this school has an amazing faculty, but UD has too.
Great, thank you.
I mean, and I guess I would say, like, as a kind of footnote to what I said a lot earlier, is that, you know, I actually came here on a full scholarship in terms of, like, the program that's here. Mm-hmm. And so part of my comments, you know, before, it's a lot easier when you don't have that weight. But I think the schools just don't have enough. I think that what Sabrina said was right. Like, there are a lot of really good people who are dedicated to doing this work who just don't have access to that work, to like scholarships, you know, personal assets, personal wealth. And, you know, I know there's some dialogue that's happening slowly with law schools to kind of, like, address this, but it's really slow in terms of, like, you know, the differential between, like, what you make when you graduate in the public, you know, you're still paying the same tuition, but you are making nothing.
I want to just add that if you are going on websites specifically, schools aren't necessarily going to be really great about advertising. There's scholarships for students that have been, or for perspectives that have had a lot of experience in working in, say, like a nonprofit. So I would think very strategically about even waiting a little while and building your sort of experience where you work. If you have been in it for a few years or just 1 year, consider staying and giving yourself, like, sort of a little bit of an, almost like an expertise or whatever you want to call it, so that when you do apply and you're going to specifically want to go to these websites and find out, there's like about 10 schools in the country that have full rides for public interest, and then you're going to be just so, you know, I guess desirable to them because you've had that work. So it's sort of that balance, like, you want to go, but maybe I should continue working a little bit more, or if it's only been a year, I don't know how long you've been working, but I do think your idea of thinking strategically about it, going to law school, getting it funded, I want to stay an organizer, is a good, I think you're on the right track.
Thank you.
I think
we need to wrap up. Do you guys have any closing remarks you'd like to make? Last spiels.
Good luck.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much.